Well, I think one thing we're going to do right out of the gate is define what pro-life is.
Scott Klusendorf talking about his presentation at the 2018 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
That term is now being confused. It's being put up for grabs, and we're going to make clear what the pro-life syllogism is, how we can make that case for life with people who don't accept biblical authority, who maybe don't even know what it is we stand for, and are subject to being confused. So there's a crying need to clarify what pro-life means, what our actual arguments are, and then we'll look at five bad ways people argue against the pro-life case in the public square so that we can be prepared to give good, solid, Christ-honoring answers.
You can meet and hear Scott Klusendorf making the case for life at the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference, Friday, June 8th and Saturday, June 9th in Collinsville, Illinois. Learn more about conference speakers and topics and register at issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. New York Times opinion piece appeared yesterday, How to Talk About Abortion. It is somewhat ironic that if you read through the entire thing, while it mentions abortion a lot, it never actually talks about what abortion is, what actually happens in abortion. In fact, in a lot of ways, the author avoids talking about what abortion really is, and especially avoids talking about who the unborn is. We're going to be getting a reaction to this opinion piece in the New York Times, How to Talk About Abortion. Joining us to do so, Megan Allman. She has a Master of Arts degree in Christian Apologetics from Biola University, and she's a speaker for Life Training Institute. Megan, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. It's an honor to be on with you.
Somebody kind of wants the lowdown on this opinion piece in the New York Times, and someone's read it. They say, look, in the end, it concludes that governments have a compelling interest in restricting abortion in the late stages of a healthy pregnancy, talking about, you know, these late-term abortions that are done on completely viable babies. Is that the real takeaway? Is that the only thing that someone needs to know about this column in the New York Times?
Absolutely not. In fact, the discussion on late-term abortions is only a small segment of the column, and even in that discussion, the author is assuming some pretty outrageous things about the unborn.
She begins by referring to abortion. I'll quote her, abortion is first and foremost a medical service or procedure. Is that true?
In some terms, that's true. It's a medical procedure, but so is pulling a tooth. She actually fails to adequately define abortion in the opening part of her article here. In fact, that was one of my major problems with it when I first read it. I kept looking for, well, what is she going to tell us what kind of medical procedure abortion is? Christopher Kather gives us the most exact definition of what abortion is. That is the intentional killing of a human fetus. And that's a definition that is accepted across the board, no matter where one stands on the issue. She fails to say that throughout until the end of her article, where she actually admits in her own wording, quote, a medical procedure in which the fetus's death is an unavoidable outcome. But that brings us to one of her major assumptions in the discussion of this article, which is, what does she mean by fetus? What is the unborn?
So how would you respond to someone who says she seems to make a distinction between a fetus and a baby who's been born alive? Is there?
There's no distinction between a fetus and a baby that's been born alive other than in terms of its size and its level of development, perhaps its location, and certainly its degree of dependency. It's no longer attached to the mother when it's born. But other than that, what is the unborn is a simple question. And not only that, it's not a religious question, something else she brings up, which we could discuss in a minute. The unborn, scientifically speaking, is a living, distinct, and whole human being from the point that it comes into existence at conception.
I want to come back to her, what you just mentioned, her sidelong definition of abortion near the very end of her column, where she says a medical procedure in which the fetus's death is an unavoidable outcome. She makes it sound as though the abortionist has some sort of end in mind of which the death of the baby is merely an unavoidable consequence, but the goal is not to terminate the life of the baby.
Right. Well, in that she defined it earlier as this medical procedure, but again, fails to tell us what kind of medical procedure. And as you just stated, Todd, what is the end in mind of this medical procedure? Again, Kather's definition, the intentional killing of a human fetus.
What else did you find in this that was most egregious to you?
Well, several of the assumptions that Laurie made, Laurie Schrage is the name of the author of this particular article. Again, she assumes throughout the article that the unborn is not human in some way, or at least not a human being like you and I are, Todd, that is persons with rights. So she is making a distinction between this fetus, this thing in the womb, and persons like you and I who would have the right to life. So she's assuming all throughout the unborn are not human. If we were to take this article and put into place everywhere that she mentions the fetus, a toddler, it would bring this into light as to one of the major problems that I have with it. When we assume that some human beings are not deserving of rights, whereas others are, we run into major issues. If toddlers were the subject of this article, nobody would read this article and walk away going, oh, that sounds pretty reasonable. We would all think she's crazy. She's also assuming a few other things that I had an issue with, more deeper issues, which she talks about the idea that we shouldn't be basing the discussion on abortion over this personal moral issue. She's kind of placing morality in a sphere where it ought not to be. In other words, she's equating moral conversations as talking about our mere preferences over something. And since people don't agree on our preference on abortion, well, we shouldn't have the conversation there. Well, that's a broad assumption, Todd, because morality is not that kind of thing. There's a popular bumper sticker that's been around for a long time that says, if you don't like abortion, then don't have one. And the major issue I have with that sticker is the same that I have with this article, the word like, as if the conversation over the issue of abortion is a preference type of conversation. As Frances Beckwith says, what if that sticker said, oh, you don't like slavery? Well, don't own one. We would immediately grasp that there was a huge issue with what that person was saying. They didn't grasp the importance of the issue. In other words, morality is not a preference type of thing. Rather, it is an objective type of conversation we have. Because when we make moral statements like abortion is morally wrong, we're not talking about our preferences. We're actually making a statement about the way the world really is, about reality. So that puts it in an entirely different realm.
Does she also place into the category of preference when human life, or as she says, personhood begins? She writes, it's well known that members of our society hold vastly different views about when personhood or human life begins. A pluralistic democratic society can accommodate a good amount of such disagreement.
Absolutely. She's placing that in a category of it's just based on your opinion. And because there are differing opinions out there, we can reach no consensus on that particular question. I reject that at the outset because the type of question it is in fact a scientific one when we are asking what is the unborn? What is this entity that we're talking about? But I also have a problem with the fact that she assumes that because there's a lack of consensus on this, that there is no real truth that's there. As Hedley Arkes, the political scientist, said, absence of consensus does not mean there's an absence of truth. And the disagreement that we have over it, I don't have a problem with disagreement, but that is not the end in mind. In other words, I don't think that's the sign of a healthy society. Oh, there's disagreement. That's where the conversation ought to begin.
A little later in the opinion piece, she cites a 2012 study on abortion in the United States published by the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, concluding that legal abortion is safer for the woman than a live birth. Does she have her facts right there?
Well, it depends on what you mean. Again, as I've been stating, we've got to keep a laser focus on that question, what is the unborn? A question that science has definitively answered for us when it says the unborn are human from the moment of conception. If we are to inject that factual information into this study, no matter the risks over that, when it says the risk of death associated with childbirth is higher, that may be true in terms of childbirth itself for the woman. But what's being excluded here is the entire people group that abortion focuses on, the intentional killing of the human fetus. So I would argue that once we have that information in light, the risk of death associated with abortion is nearly 100% because there is always a human death involved, and that is the ends in mind when it comes to abortion.
And even if, and I won't concede this, but even if bringing a pregnancy to term were more risky for the woman than an abortion, that wouldn't change the issue of whether abortion is right or wrong, would it?
No, not at all. Not when it comes to abortion. It's a different type of conversation, a medical one. But the rightness of wrongness of abortion deals with what abortion actually is and does, Todd.
What do you make of her conclusion where she says, given these risks, access to legal abortion is, in general, life and health preserving for women?
Life and health preserving for which women would be my first question. Certainly not the unborn ones who are being killed through abortion. Again, it assumes the unborn are not human and not part of this larger conversation.
Does she inadvertently trip into the main issue when she says the state also has an interest in protecting fetal life even if fetuses are not legal persons?
She begins to concede something there, as the federal law as it's written does, that at some point in time, maybe we can say that we have some kind of interest here. But again, she's avoiding what the unborn is and giving the unborn some kind of a functional value at that point. In other words, she cites viability as a possible reason. She doesn't really ever actually talk about the unborn in particular, other than the fetus is viable at that point. She still is directing her attention on the health of the mother, the decisions made by the medical staff. Again, the same assumption is consistent throughout the article, that these unborn children are not humans of full value. But because she begins to concede there, we see a wavering in, well, what begins to happen here and there? At the end of the day, the unborn is human from conception all the way through pregnancy up until birth. Being a human being from the beginning, there is no morally relevant difference between that unborn child any earlier than that point and you and me sitting here talking today, Todd.
What do you make of this statement late in the column? If in the future a public consensus on the question of when human personhood begins, then we would need to recognize that there is more than one quote-unquote patient involved in an abortion.
I've got to give her credit for at least giving that a nod. But my problem is that she's placing this on public consensus on this question, as if the question hasn't already been answered, and as if public consensus is the thing that rules the day. In other words, majority opinion is what drives public policy. Well, at the time when slavery was rampant in our country, we would look back on that and go, hey, whoa, just because everyone thought that human beings could be bought and sold like chattel, that did not make that okay. Our policy has to be based on something else. That is what we are as human beings, grounded in our very nature, made in the image of God. And so when she begins to say things like that, she's getting close to the mark, but still missing it with a wide berth.
So finally, Megan, she seems to want to depolarize the debate over abortion. If we really want to focus on the main issue of who is the unborn and depolarize the debate, how does that happen?
Todd, I think that the only way that can happen, because the real issue here is what is the unborn, the moral status of that unborn child. And because we are approaching this argument as one that is scientifically and philosophically grounded, the unborn are living, distinct, whole human beings from the moment they come into existence, and that there is no morally relevant difference between that unborn child and us that would say that it's okay to kill you then, but not now. That is the main issue. The disagreement on that, abortion either takes an innocent human life or it does not. So when we look at what the pro-life view has to say, what we see is that it is actually more inclusive, in fact, inclusive of all human beings as beings who are to be recognized as persons with rights and with intrinsic worth. If we can get there and we can understand that, then what we'll have is much less confusion and I think a more just and wholesome society. So the very thing she's trying to achieve here will only get there when we begin to recognize true things about what the unborn is when it comes to abortion.
Megan Ullman has a Master of Arts degree in Christian Apologetics from Biola University, and she's a speaker for Life Training Institute. Learn more about Life Training Institute at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. Megan, thank you for your time.
Thanks, Todd.
In Hour 2 of Issues, Etc. on this Tuesday afternoon, we continue our series on the Lutheran Confessions, Part 10 of the Apology of the Augsburg Confession. We'll be talking about repentance, and the Reformers are going to focus in on how forgiveness of sins is obtained. Their answer, by faith alone. Pastor Paul McCain is with us after the break.
Defending life, from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.